From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Gail Harris, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. As a senior producer for CBS News and CNN, Richard Cohen traveled the world to bring back other people's stories, their hopes, their struggles, their pain. Now he's telling the remarkable story of his 30-year battle with MS and more. Tonight on Point, Richard Cohen's reluctant memoir. But first, three U.S. envoys were expected to arrive in Israel late today to try again to jumpstart the peace process there. Meanwhile, this week, Israeli lawmakers approved $22 million in new spending for settlements in the West Bank. Dan Efron is foreign correspondent for Newsweek magazine. I asked him about the plan for new settlements just 2 weeks after Prime Minister Ariel Sharon had said that he would remove most of the settlements from the Gaza Strip.
I think what's important to remember is that while Sharon is talking about removing settlers from the Gaza Strip, and that is a departure from things that he has said and done in the past, Sharon's strategy is to take settlers out of one area, but to tighten Israel's grip over settlements in another area, that is the West Bank. So we are continuing to see incentives to settlers to go live in the West Bank, not in the Gaza Strip anymore, but in settlements in the West Bank. And this is part and parcel. These were $20 million that the Knesset Finance Committee approved for young couples to be able to get all kinds of incentives for cheaper housing, for tax breaks, and so on, in settlements in the West Bank that Sharon certainly hopes and intends to hang on to. American officials are here in the region. One of the things we're hearing is that he's talking to them about a kind of quid pro quo. He will give up settlements in the Gaza Strip, and maybe he can get the United States to recognize some kind of Israeli annexation of some settlements in the West Bank.
Well, what about that? As you say, there are U.S. envoys expected in Israel late Wednesday night. They're trying to unfreeze the peace talks, but I can't imagine that this is going to be a helpful development, is it?
I don't think that unfreezing the peace talks is something they can do, certainly not in this round of negotiation or mediation. I think that for them, the immediate goal is to scout out what Sharon intends to do when he talks about unilateral separation. I think what mainly concerns the United States is that when Sharon withdraws from Gaza, when he puts up that fence, that he doesn't do things that would preclude negotiations in the future. In other words, I think the U.S. position now is, okay, this roadmap has not worked. This peace plan is not going forward. But let's make sure that what Sharon does in the guise of unilateral separation doesn't preclude a situation where 2 years from now or 5 years from now, when there are leaderships on both sides here that are more amenable to negotiations, that then they cannot come to some kind of agreement because of the facts on the ground established now.
Well, the reaction from the Palestinian labor minister was that this showed Sharon's policy was settlement expansion, and he said this policy makes peace impossible now. Is that the way it's playing in Israel?
It's certainly the Palestinian perspective. I wouldn't want to undercut the significance of Sharon's decision a few weeks ago to pull settlers out of the Gaza Strip. Sharon, as we know, for more than 20 years, has really been the godfather of the settlement movement in the West Bank and Gaza. And if he does go ahead with this move, if this is not just rhetoric, if he pulls the settlers out of Gaza, this will be very dramatic. There has never been even one settlement that any Israeli government, including Israeli governments in the center or on the left, have managed to evacuate in the West Bank and Gaza. So he certainly has set for himself a formidable agenda in taking on the settlers, the very people who gave him support in these elections. But again, it would be a mistake to look at this as a new Sharon who doesn't support settlements at all anymore. I think it's a way to be able to tighten Israel's grip, as I said, over other settlements in the West Bank.
And there's another element to the story. The United Nations has asked the World Court in The Hague for an opinion on the legality of Israel's construction of a security wall. That's supposed to happen February 23rd. Israel has until Friday to decide whether or not to participate in oral arguments. How's that playing?
Israel is quite concerned about the court, I think in part because Israel feels that decisions at the UN, certainly at the UN General Assembly, tend to be lip service. They tend to be symbolic. But that a court decision or something that's decided in some legal framework might actually come back to haunt Israel in some legally binding way. And so Israel's decision was, on the one hand, to file a legal brief to the court that argues against this court involving itself in the issue of the fence. And that's the issue that the court will talk about, the legality of the fence. But on the other hand, I think there was a decision here on the part of Israelis not to attend the hearings, not to be present and deliver oral arguments, so as not to legitimize, as it were, the court's decision. I think Israel's position is that this court should not be discussing matters that pertain to conflicts between nations, that the court should be discussing issues of criminality and not national or international conflict.
There's a quote here from the foreign ministry official who says that Israel just doesn't want to participate in this because they view it as a circus, that it is putting them on trial when they feel it should be Palestinian terrorism that should be in the dock.
Well, that's right. And what they point out continually about this barrier that Israel is building in the West Bank is that a couple of years ago, Israel had no intention of separating between Israelis and Palestinians, that it really is the result of waves and waves of Palestinian suicide bombings. So Israel is saying this is not the thing that an international court should be getting into, and even if it is, the court should take into account that Israel has been through 3.5 years of sustained Palestinian violence.
And Dan, there were also reports today about how the Palestinian Authority could actually be on the brink of collapse. We have heard that before, but these signs seem to be more compelling, that the European nations that have been the largest source of aid to the Palestinians, many of them are saying they're going to reduce their financial assistance, that there's chaos and corruption, even being acknowledged among Palestinians about the Palestinian security forces.
That's right. People have been talking for a couple of years now about the potential for chaos in the West Bank and Gaza Strip. It has not happened yet, but I would agree that things do look more bleak in terms of domestic stability for Palestinians than they have in a very long time. It's hard to talk about any kind of central leadership. The finances that keep afloat the Palestinian Authority, as you say, have been dwindling. And what that means on the ground is that a good number of Palestinians, perhaps 30% of the wage earners in the West Bank and Gaza, are civil servants. They're people who get their money from the Palestinian Authority. And the weaker the authority becomes, the harder it is for them to pay these salaries. All these things are happening while other groups, Islamic groups particularly, in the West Bank and Gaza, have been growing stronger over the last 3 years. And there is concern, certainly among Palestinians like Yasser Arafat, among observers in the European Union, that the weaker the Palestinian Authority gets, the stronger the Islamists get in the West Bank and Gaza. And perhaps even some people see a day when the Islamic Hamas group, for instance, would be the strongest group in the West Bank and Gaza.
In other words, if there's a power vacuum, Hamas is poised to fill it.
That's exactly right. They have a very disciplined group, both on a political level and a military level, and I think certainly some people on Hamas see themselves as the heirs to the Palestinian Authority.
Well, Dan Efron, a complicated story as always. Thanks for making it clear for us.
Thank you.
Dan Efron is foreign correspondent for Newsweek magazine. He spoke with me from Jerusalem. Welcome to my world, writes journalist Richard Cohen in his new memoir, Blindsided, where I carry around dreams, a few diseases, and the determination to live life my way. At age 25, the young TV news producer was diagnosed with multiple sclerosis. He went on to become a senior producer at CBS and CNN. He got married and fathered 3 children. It's a great story, but it's not the whole story. 30 years on, MS and 2 bouts with colon cancer have taken their toll on Cohen's body, soul, career, and family. Tonight on Point, Richard Cohen's reluctant memoir. And so we ask, does it take adversity to figure out who we are? What does illness teach us about ourselves and other people? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And joining me now from New York is Richard Cohen, journalist and author of the new book, Blindsided, Lifting a Life Above Illness. Welcome, Richard.
Good evening.
It's nice to have you with us, and thank you also for a powerful and poignant book, which, as noted, you call a reluctant memoir. Why so? Most people are not at all reluctant to write about themselves.
Well, I once was a private person, and for me it was a long and difficult journey to go from the secrecy of being diagnosed with a debilitating illness, needing to protect myself, worrying about jobs and relationships, and really keeping my mouth shut, to a point where I could not only talk about it, but began to write about it, both in the New York Times and in the book. You know, in Blindsided, I wrote about my journey from newsrooms through operating rooms to a more reflective life. And I think part of that reflective existence is understanding the value of sharing experiences. And I have come to believe that too often those of us who are ill isolate ourselves, sort of pull back, really withdraw into ourselves. And I'm really trying not to do that, but it's difficult. And the book is more revealing and certainly more raw than I ever thought I was going to write. And that process really was a reluctant process.
Mm. Well, and beautifully written, too, I should point out. Take us to the moment when you first began to suspect that there was something going on with your body that you needed to pay attention to, because you were only 25, and as I recall, 25, that's an age when most of us think we are pretty invincible.
Not only that, but those of us who think that we hit the target professionally, and I really did because I discovered television news, think that we're on a path upward and nothing's going to stop us. And for me, it was a curious story of a single day where I dropped a coffee pot, fell off a curb, and noticed numbness in my left leg. And I was chatting with my father. And I was describing how this man is a retired physician who also, but then was not retired, and he also has MS. And I described the symptoms, and he said, well, you know, go see a doctor, you need a physical, blah, blah, blah. And we hung up the phone, and it couldn't have been 5 minutes later when it rang, and it was my father, and he said, I think you have multiple sclerosis. And I literally took the phone away from my ear and looked at it. This was an old-fashioned doc, you know, a guy who didn't jump to conclusions and couldn't be rattled. And I think he just spotted it. And that moment, literally that moment, 30, going on 31 years ago, was the beginning of a journey.
Had you known anything at that time about both your father and your grandmother's experiences with MS?
My dad had told us when we were in school, but being a man of few words, it took on the feel of a presidential press conference where there were no questions. And he just sort of, he briefed us and left the room. And I wanted to say, thank you, Mr. President, but I didn't. And really, I mean, this was just his way, and I don't mean that in any mean-spirited way myself, but I think it was his way of saying really as much as he was comfortable saying in the moment. And it took some, as a matter of fact, it really took a diagnosis for me to begin the process of understanding the illness.
Well, we're going to continue exploring all that and its ramifications. After we take a break, we're talking this hour with Richard Cohen, who is author of the new book, Blindsided, Lifting a Life Above Illness, the story of his personal battle with MS and cancer and life. Does adversity show us the way? When you think about all the stresses in your own life, at work or at home, can you even imagine walking in Richard Cohen's shoes? What does illness teach us about the people we love, the work we do, about ourselves? We invite you to join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Gail Harris, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Gail Harris in for Tom Ashbrook, and we're talking this hour with journalist Richard Cohen about his new book, Blindsided, Lifting a Life Above Illness, his reluctant memoir about his 30-year battle with MS and cancer, about his love and joy and anger through those years. What do you hear in Richard Cohen's story? Are we only valued by society when we are healthy and whole? How have you dealt with the struggles of chronic illness, and have those struggles made you and your family stronger? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And again, we're continuing our conversation with Richard Cohen about his new book, his gritty and graceful memoir about battles with serious illness and what they bring to life and love and family. Richard, I want to ask you about one of the big issues for you, which you alluded to a moment ago, was how truthful to be with people. It's clearly a difficult topic for anybody, but especially for someone who is in the truth business. You know, as a reporter, it's your job to ferret out the truth. So how were you able to grapple with that?
Well, it's a very difficult question for anybody suffering with really any kind of an illness and looking for work, either to find work or to hold on to a job. It's especially ironic, I suppose, to be in the news business where you do value truth and honesty and candor to find yourself lying and obfuscating and cutting every corner you can to get a job. I mean, the best example of that, and I'll try and make it brief, is when I was 30 years old and was offered the coveted job of being a producer on the CBS Evening News with Walter Cronkite. And I was overjoyed to get the job. And they said, of course, you've got to do a contract and fill out paperwork. And, of course, take the company physical. And I thought, the company physical.
Uh-oh.
And I gave an enormous amount of thought to what I was going to do about the physical. And and I had tried to be open and honest when I left Columbia, the journalism school, and people had turned away from me when they found out about the illness. And I wanted this job too badly to let truth get in the way. And as I said in the book, the H in honor is silent, and I chose the same course. And I literally faked my way through the physical. I talked the nurse into testing one eye twice, because that eye was not as badly impaired as the other eye. Today I'm legally blind. It wasn't quite as bad in those days. But it takes a toll on your self-esteem or your sense of self to go down that road. It's a terrible way to get a job. But I'll tell you, I stayed friendly with Sandy Sokolow, who's a wonderful man, was Cronkite's longtime executive producer. And Sandy said to me in the year, he was the one I finally told when I decided that I was safe at CBS and I didn't want them to hear it from other people. And his response to me was, I'm glad you didn't tell me. I don't think I would have hired you. And this is it's a stunning admission from somebody who's in the business, among other things, of hiring people. But I think, you know, I think on one hand that we all want to believe that 20-something years later, things are different. But I don't think things are different. I think that in difficult economic times, when jobs are so highly prized and managers are under so much pressure to cut costs and be productive, they are not going to take a chance on somebody they see as limited. Now, you and I perhaps can take a different view of what the word limited means. I could argue to you that I might bring qualities to a job that a more fit person might not bring, but they're not going to buy that. You know, I think that they're looking for fit, able-bodied people because everybody's under pressure. So I think I feel bad for anybody who's in this sort of a situation. Honesty is a luxury that pays off in some situations, but I'm not sure in the workplace it's much rewarded.
Hmm. Well, and also I have a practical question. How in the world did you pull this off? Because TV producers are the folks who have to go into unfamiliar places and situations and scope them out quickly, at the very least have to be able to get around and react quickly. So how were you able to do that, given the challenges that you faced at the time?
Well, I was terrified most of the time. You know, I mean, producers are expected to jump out of airplanes without a parachute and land safely, scope out the story, and somehow get it on the air. And when you can't even rent a car, you know, and travel by yourself, you're in a compromised position. But I just bluffed my way through it for a while. And then when it sort of became known within the organization, I relied more on other people, not with total honesty or candor, but just admissions of having bad vision or whatever. In those days, I mean, today I walk with a cane. I'm very obviously affected by the MS. You can hear it in my voice. It's been hit badly. And I've lost more eyesight than I had lost in those days. I could hide it more easily in those days. But it was tough, and I'll tell you, I covered two wars in Beirut in 82 and Salvador the next year and found myself in very hairy situations. But I think I was trying to prove something to myself that I could do it. Mm. And it was all tied up in what I think are the very common sort of psychological needs that a lot of people who suffer with illness have.
Well, and particularly, as you say, you certainly weren't sitting at a desk in New York. You were in war zones. And I wonder if there was some part of you that perhaps felt impervious to the danger of being there, since you lived with such uncertainty every day.
There was a little of that. There really was. And also, I think that anybody who goes out and puts himself or herself in those kinds of situations almost suspends the disbelief that is dangerous. You know, I mean, Winston Churchill was a war correspondent during the Boer War at the turn of the century, the last century now. And he wrote that nothing is so exhilarating as to be shot at with no result. And I really understood that. There's just something about being out there with the adrenaline rush. And I wanted a taste of it, and I got it. And it really wasn't until I got in some jams in El Salvador that it occurred to me that what I was doing was reckless.
Mm. And there is, of course, the old cliche about how people who lose their sight find that their other senses become more acute. Was that also your experience?
Yeah, I think there's real truth to that. Anybody who knows the perils of the streets of New York and has to deal with some of these limitations would identify with this. I use my ears a lot more than I ever realized I do. I use my sense of smell a lot more, and it doesn't fully compensate by any means for being able to see clearly. But there are a lot of different definitions of seeing clearly, and sometimes I think I see more clearly than people with perfect eyes.
Hmm. Well, Richard, we have some folks who want to talk to you. Let's go to Warwick, Rhode Island, first of all, and hear from Denise. Welcome to the program, Denise.
Thanks. I just want to say thank you for sharing your story. I recently lost my mother after a long bout with a chronic illness. And one of the things that we discovered as she became more and more ill and was less able to do things for herself was the faith and the hope and the love that we had in our family. And I wonder if you might want to comment on how that's affected your life.
I think you're absolutely right. I think that it's the equivalent, it's the 21st century equivalent of circling the wagons, which they did in the push westward. I think that family and children offer a tremendous well of support, and really just the love that gives you the blanket that says security on it, you know. And I think a family is a just a vitally important piece of the pie, you know, of the puzzle as you try and cope with illness.
Denise, thanks for the call. Let's get into that a little more, Richard, because it is a wonderful love story that you tell between you and your wife, Meredith Vieira, who many people are familiar with, obviously, through her years on CBS and now on The View and on Who Wants to Be a Millionaire. What has kept you going? How have you been able to keep it together? And how do you overcome that image of, noble wife and, grateful husband?
That's a very touchy question. Just to refer to the latter part of the question, it makes me utterly crazy, and I was very pleased to address it in the book, the way that the magazines and the tabloids have decided to tell the story, that they think that it's interesting alone makes me wonder. But it was very important, with their cookbook, to emphasize Meredith the martyr and Richard the victim. And
you paint a different picture.
No, I really do. I mean, our lives, and I will bet that sick people all over, anybody listening to this would agree with this, that our lives are not dominated or defined by illness. The struggle is for all of us to lift ourselves, and I loved that verb, to lift, because I think that's what we do, to lift ourselves above it, you know. And I mean, my feeling is, you know, this is my only shot, unless you know something I don't know, and I want to live it my way, and I want to have the opportunities and the relationships and the love that other people have. And it's just a different kind of a struggle. But it takes, I'll tell you, the people who are special and the people who are the heroes are not the sick people. It's the people around us. Mm-hmm. You know, it's the family people and the kids who wear the armor, the emotional armor, and develop this extraordinary resilience. And it's not easy. I'm 6'2", and it's not easy to carry a guy who's 6'2" on your back. But in a lot of ways, they really do that.
Mm. Well, and you are very candid in the book about your rage. Understandable that you would feel some. Was there something specific that would set you off, and how did your family react?
Well, I think the second time I had colon cancer, it was really devastating, and it wasn't supposed to happen. It really, talk about blindsided. I mean, it caught all of us by surprise. It was, 7-hour surgery, very invasive, an ileostomy, a bag for a while, and it kicked in a lot of the MS problems, and I really came home from the hospital a diminished person. I could barely stand up. We had to put a stool in the bathroom so I could sit to brush my teeth because I couldn't stand up long enough to do it. And it was certainly my darkest moment. And I brought that darkness into the house. It's something that I think happens without us knowing it sometimes. And it put Meredith and the kids in a very difficult position. I think it was very hard on young people, the young people in our house. And how we got out of it just emotionally was really an interesting story, and it involved dialogue and some things I wrote in the Times specifically about having to deal with it. And we came out whole. We really did. And I do believe that. But the people who surround sickness really deserve the medals, not those of us who lie in the hospital bed.
Mm. And what were you and Meredith able to do in terms of giving your kids some armor, you know, when Daddy falls down the stairs? That has to be terrifying.
Well, we didn't tell them for a while about the MS. And, you wait until you think it's the appropriate time. And I suppose there really never is a totally comfortable time. But events forced the issue. I took a bad fall down the stairs. And I think, as I recall, questions just started being asked. we turned a corner very quickly, and that corner was realizing that that you've got to be open about this stuff, that that kids are the smartest ones in the house. We like to say that's not hard in our house. And they know what's going on. They're no dummies. And if you want your kid to be not just happy but secure, you know, to understand what's going on around him or her, you got to open up. You got to tell them the truth. And when the cancer came along, we sat down and we were just totally honest, you know. And when we didn't have an answer, we didn't pretend we had an answer. And Gabe, our middle son, you know, asked the first question, and that was, "Are you going to die?" And I said, "No, I don't think I am." And his second question was, "Will we get our Hanukkah and Christmas presents?" And I thought, he's got his priorities straight.
Well, and as you say, you, in addition to the MS, you also had to deal with not one but two bouts of colon cancer. So at some point you had to have been wondering, why me?
Yeah, but, you know, that just doesn't take you anywhere. I grew up because my old man has MS and has no patience for self-indulgence. I really grew up in a culture that said, keep moving, you know, go forward, quit bellyaching, get a life. And it really has served, I think, served everybody well.
You were speaking earlier about the tough time when you were understandably angry and the effects that that had on your family. Were you aware of how that was all playing out yourself, or were you pretty much absorbed in what was going on in your own body, and it took you a while to realize what impact all this was having?
Very much the latter. I think that and I can't speak for anybody else, I found that I got very self-absorbed. I suppose you really can't help it to some extent, but I was oblivious. I really was oblivious to the way I was treating people, and Meredith would gently chide me. I mean, she would tell the kids to cut me slack, and they did, and they were terrific, but they were getting isolated from me, growing, alienated, really. And finally, Meredith said, "You're becoming a monster." Those really were her words. "You're becoming a monster, and you're not the only one in this house." And I heard her, you know, and we began what was, for me, an interesting process, but it was very difficult.
Well, we're going to continue our conversation just a moment after we take a break. We're talking this hour about the daily struggles for emotional and physical health in the face of devastating illness with Richard Cohen, author of the new book, Blindsided, Lifting a Life Above Illness. You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Gail Harris. This is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Gail Harris, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook, and we're talking this hour about the effects of chronic debilitating illness on work, marriage, family, and self with Richard Cohen, author of the new memoir, Blindsided, about his 30-year battle with MS and his two bouts of colon cancer. What does illness teach us about the people we love, about the work we do, about ourselves? What do you hear in Richard Cohen's daily struggles to just keep on keeping on? His temper, his anger, his sense of humor? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Let's go to Madison, Wisconsin, and hear from Devin. Hello, Devin, and welcome.
Thank you. I appreciate Mr. Cohen sharing your story with us. It's quite inspirational, and I can only imagine the courage it would take to share such a story. My question is, or comment would be, as a healthy individual, I haven't, fortunately, have not had the experience of going through any traumatic illnesses, or neither has anybody in my family. But I'd like to still see if there's a way, or maybe you could give us some advice on what making the jump from, without having to go through the traumatic experiences you have, if you have any advice for how to get to that point. And it seems like it's a life-altering point. And without, I don't know if I'm making my point clear enough for you, and I apologize for that, but to get to the point where you are without having to go through that process.
Thank you, Devin. Actually, it is something, Richard. I was struck by your line when you said there are those who kill with concern, you know, but I'm sure you can understand why people don't always know what to say to you or how to deal with the illness. So, you know, help us out here. What should we do when someone's grappling with the kind of health issues that you're talking about?
You know, I don't think that, and Lord knows I don't speak for the citizens of sickness here. You know, I mean, there are a lot of people in this land, 90 million, with chronic illnesses. I suspect that we don't want anything in particular from anyone except perhaps for them to understand our journey. You know, I mean, I sometimes think that I don't believe in complaining. I mean, I'd like to think I never used MS as an excuse for a job not done. But I sometimes wish that people understood the odds, you know, that people understood the pressures and just the difficulties, because people with chronic illnesses so often have so much trouble day to day. I mean, my day, and it's hard to talk about because you instantly sound like you're kvetching. And I keep saying, somebody once asked me if I was Job, and I said, no, Job was a kvetch, you know, and I don't want to be one. But you know, a day in my life is tough. You know, a day in a lot of other lives is equally tough, I'm sure. I guess I, on some level, wish people understood that a little bit. But if the question was to reach a point of being able to cope, and I'm not sure I understood the question exactly, I believe that people cope with problems in relationships, in the workplace, personal disappointments, and health problems in a very similar fashion. I don't think you react or anyone reacts to a challenge to your health any differently from a challenge to your marriage or your job. And I think, you know, once you add those in, you know, that you're just about covering everybody in America. So I guess I would only say that that we all have a lot to learn, and Lord knows I've taken 30 years to learn it, and I know I'm still not there. But I think we all have a lot to learn about taking a deep breath, stepping back, assessing our problems, and dealing with them. And it's a challenge for all of us.
And in fact, you tell a wonderfully ironic story about how some of your neighbors thought you had a drinking problem when you had trouble walking. They were actually somewhat relieved to hear that it was, quote unquote, only MS. And I guess that's one of the things that came out when you began using the cane.
No, it actually, in retrospect, was pretty humorous. People with MS, beyond the equilibrium problems and the limping, frequently speak with a slur when they're a little bit tired. I'm a little bit tired tonight, and I can hear the slur, perhaps you can't, in my own voice. And I went into a wine store to bring home a bottle of wine, and it couldn't have been 2 in the afternoon, and then they would not serve me the wine because they assumed I was inebriated. I've walked up a hill from the train where we live and heard a car idling behind me more than once and turned around, and it was the police. And obviously following the drunk up the hill to see if he's going to make it home. And I think that there was this misimpression in the land about me. And, you know, one of the funny things about using a cane, and I only took to the cane about 8 years ago, is that you really finally send a signal. You know, you finally go public. You're out of the closet. You're admitting it to the world. Everything you may have tried to hide, even though probably you weren't too successful doing it. And you know, you pose the rhetorical question, what does illness teach us about ourselves? Adversity introduces us to ourselves. Illness is a fabulous teacher. It's not the course I would have elected to take, And nor am I getting any credit for it. But I am. I learn about myself every day. You know, I learn my strengths and my weaknesses, my foibles. I learn what's good about me and not, what's not so good about me. And I think illness does one of the nice or more positive things about it is that I think you just get tuned in more effectively than other people who are too busy running around and living their lives to pay much attention to what's going on inside.
Hmm. Well, and as you describe the process, you say at one point, you know, I get there. It may take me a little longer. I may be a little unsteady. And you also say that I provide a great deal of entertainment in the streets. So have you discovered the secret of just not caring what other people think?
No, I haven't. And when I fall, as happens more than I'd like, it's because I can trip and go sprawling over a sidewalk crack. And it's humiliating. And the sad thing is that it's not a question of the way other people react to me, because people are generally very nice and very solicitous. And it's much more a function of what's in my head. You know, and I can never, I apologize to people. I apologize profusely when I fall. It makes no sense. And it reveals, I think, a shame at being in this condition. And without asking all the therapists in your audience to phone me, I think one of my journeys is to learn more than I've learned, even after all these years, about why I feel almost guilty about having the illness.
Hmm. If I can quote you to you one more time, you say that there is power in the idea that things could be worse and that making peace is not a one-shot deal but an effort that spans a lifetime. So I wonder, what would you say to those of us who are healthy but may be numb to life in ways that you are not?
Well, you know, God bless you, because I wouldn't wish this on anybody. And again, I'm not suggesting that the upside compensates for the downside. Yeah, obviously, we could all do with a little sensitivity training and a little more self-knowledge in our lives. And it's odd, but that's one of the things the illness really does teach you, and it's not bad.
Well, we thank you for teaching us so beautifully, Richard Cohen. Appreciate your being with us tonight.
Thank you.
Richard Cohen is the author of the new book, Blindsided, Lifting a Life Above Illness. And you can continue the conversation online at onpointradio.org. Click on Forums. In just a moment, looking through the cold for the first signs of spring. This is On Point. By any standard, it has been a brutal winter in much of the country this year. Just this week, record low temperatures were set in cities from Rochester, New York, to Salt Lake City, Utah. Boston had its coldest January in over 100 years. And according to America's groundhog, Punxsutawney Phil, the end of winter is still a ways off. Naturalist Ken Kaufman is editor of the Kaufman Focus Guide series, the palm-sized guides carried by birdwatchers and nature lovers. In this radio diary, he says that despite the deep freeze, the first signs of spring are starting to emerge.
A few days ago, talking with a friend, I made some reference to Groundhog Day and asked her if she expected 6 more weeks of winter. It was an offhand question, so I was surprised when she started yelling at me that I was being cruel. I hadn't meant to be, but I was calling from the beach in San Diego, and my friend was in Connecticut. And there, as in many places, this has been a very serious winter. Of course, I apologized and started talking about the approach of spring, but I could tell that she wasn't convinced. After all, this is February, As we talked, I was having vivid flashbacks to the coldest February of my own life, years ago, during the first winter that I spent in upstate New York. That winter actually wasn't unusual as far as official records went, but for me personally, it was a record breaker. I was living with my girlfriend in a trailer park at the edge of a college town upstate, and I had watched the onset of winter with a mix of fascination and dread. The last butterflies of the summer disappeared in September. The first snow fell in October, and by November, the last brittle brown leaves had been swept out of the trees by the icy wind. December was endless. January was more so. By the 1st of February, I had this hopeless feeling that winter was a permanent state. On the night of Groundhog Day, the low was near zero, but on some perverse whim, I decided to go out for a walk. I don't know, maybe I thought that that would make our trailer seem warm by comparison. Whatever the reason, I was walking the deserted back roads, feeling sorry for myself, when a distant sound brought me up short. It was the low, muffled hooting of a great horned owl. My first thought was that the owl must be complaining about the cold, like I was. But as I walked in the direction of the sound, I realized that I was hearing two owls, and there was nothing casual or coincidental about their voices. They were hooting back and forth, animated, excited, with an urgency that belied the dead calm of the winter landscape. The two owls were a male and a female, and they were in the throes of romance, courtship, getting ready for the nesting season. Up to that point, I had thought of great horned owls mainly as supreme nocturnal predators. I had known that they had incredible eyesight and hearing, powerful talons, and soft plumage that muffled the sound of their flight. I had imagined them ranging over the countryside at night to capture everything from rats to rabbits, from snakes to skunks. I had never thought of them as signs of spring. But that pair of owls became my lifeline to the next season. Night after night that February, I went out to listen to their wild hooting. I went exploring in the daytime, too, and before the end of the month, I found their nest in a dense woodlot. The female was already on the nest, sitting on eggs. When I saw that, I knew that winter was coming to an end. You know, despite our tradition of Groundhog Day, the groundhog itself is a lousy predictor of spring. In early February, it's underground in deep hibernation, and if it happens to come out on a mild day, it will be grouchy, disoriented, not at all interested in questions about its shadow. We can't always judge the season by plant life either, because some plants are fooled into greening up during midwinter thaws, and others wait until it's practically summer. But when the birds announce the approach of spring, it means something. Already, here in the depths of February, some birds are migrating north. The killdeers, with their plaintive cries, and the soft-voiced little phoebes are on the move, and they may reach the northern tier of states by early March. And in the north woods, the great horned owls are engaged in the rites of spring, proving that, for them, the season has already arrived.
Ken Kaufman is editor of the Kaufman Focus Guide series and a regular contributor to On Point. He lives in Tucson, Arizona. I'm Gail Harrison for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.